If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Saturday, October the 3rd, and you're listening to a special weekend edition of Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution, as well as the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today joining me from across the San Francisco Bay and taking a break from numerous TV hits is my colleague, John Yu. John Yu is a visiting fellow here at the Hoover Institution and a professor at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. John co-hosts the Hoover's Pacific Century podcast with Misha Oslin. John's also an author. His book, Defender in Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power, is published this summer. And John is an expert on the United States Constitution. John, this is the third podcast you and I have done in recent weeks, and we keep coming back to this document called the Constitution. I was thinking in preparing for this that that document is now, what, 230 plus years old, but it seems to be a pretty sturdy piece of writing.
You know, I think the founders actually thought ahead a lot, and they did think a lot about things like this. The other thing is that Trump, but I talk about this a little bit in my book, he's exploring every nook and cranny of the Constitution, some like picking a president without a majority in the Electoral College, which we talked about last time, hasn't been used in 200 years.
Yeah. Well, I don't think one thing the founders thought about, John, was pandemic and Supreme Court nominations and the president in the hospital with only 4 weeks and a couple of days before the election. So let's talk about Judge Barrett's nomination. And just to kind of quickly recap, and those of you listening, John and I are recording this at a little after 11 o'clock in the morning, California time. So that's, what, a little after 2 on the East Coast. My apologies if any news has stepped on what we're about to talk about. But John, here's the rundown. First of all, who has the virus now? The President of the United States, the First Lady of the United States, Kellyanne Conway and Hope Hicks, both White House aides. Bill Stepien, who's Trump's campaign manager, he has it. In a past life, he was a campaign manager for Chris Christie when he's running for re-election in New Jersey. Governor Christie now has it. Republican National Committee Chair Ronald Romney has it. And three United States senators, three Republicans, Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, Tom Tillis from North Carolina, Mike Lee from Utah. Two of those gentlemen are on the Senate Judiciary Committee. They were at the Rose Garden ceremony a couple of weeks ago, as were a lot of the other people on this list. Also with it is Notre Dame President, Reverend John Jenkins. He has tested positive for the virus. You may be asking, what about Judge Barrett and her husband? They reportedly both had COVID this summer, but recovered. I have read up on this. She reportedly gets tested every day. But John, let's talk now about the mechanics of her nomination going forward. Lindsey Graham, the Senate Judiciary Committee chair, has said October 12th, a week from this Monday, is a starting date. Meanwhile, the Senate's in pro forma session. You have two committee members down right now. Do you think this is going to be a virtual hearing, as was James Comey's the other week?
Yes. The one thing that's happened because of the pandemic, and here I'm putting on my hat as a former general counsel of that committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, is they've adapted by allowing for a lot of virtual proceedings. You have seen already different hearings where witnesses have appeared by video. You've got hearings where I think even senators have appeared by two-way video. So I don't think there's anything that requires that the senators for the hearings be there in person. It'll be the first time ever in the history of Supreme Court nominations that you've had much or part of the hearings done by video, but there's nothing in the rules that prohibits it. So I don't see any reason why the committee hearings can't go forward. Although the Democrats have threatened, even before this all happened, to try to disrupt the hearings, there are various procedural rules that can be used by the Senate Democrats to shorten the hearings, to stop them from going on, for example, for more than 2 hours a day. But other than that, I think the hearings will go forward and they'll be completed that week.
Right. So what you're suggesting is if two members have tested positive, they could be quarantined, but they could still participate in the committee proceedings.
In fact, this is the thing you never see is when you get to the lower court hearings, suppose you did the hearings 3 years ago where you had, then Professor Barrett testifying to become Judge Barrett, you will usually only have one Republican and one Democratic senator in there conducting the whole hearing.
Right. Which is kind of all you need in this case because she was up, in 2017. So in terms of fresh material to go over, there's not a lot there, it seems. But here's the question, John. So if you have two committee members who cannot physically show up, can committee votes be done by proxy or do you have to be there in person?
That's an interesting question, Phil. It's up to each committee. And the Senate Judiciary Committee, even back in the day when I was there, when Orrin Hatch was the chair, and Joe Biden was the ranking member, and you had people like Strom Thurmond still around, and so on, you could vote by proxy. So as long as there's enough people there to have it's called the executive committee meeting, when you vote on the nomination itself, as long as you have a quorum, you can have proxy voting. Usually that executive committee meeting takes place about a week after the hearing, and then the minority has a right to delay it by a week. So I would say the earliest you would have a vote in the committee would be the two weeks after the end of the hearings.
Right. So the guess is that she would be confirmed by the full Senate, John, in the week before the election. I've seen October the 29th, which I think is a Thursday, as a date that's thrown out. But let me ask you this, John, can the Senate do floor votes by proxy as well, or do senators have to be there in person?
So this is interesting. This is really interesting, Bill. The House introduced such a rule, but the Senate has not. So the Senate, you still have to appear in person to vote. And I think the reason why that's been resisted by senators, they always want to say they're different than the House, but it underscores again the power of the majority leader, Mitch McConnell. The majority leader doesn't have power, unlike the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has in her chamber. The Senate really doesn't have that many rules, but the one rule that McConnell has, is the power to schedule. And so he could, right, even though there's some senators available, some senators not, he can schedule votes in a way to try to maximize the likelihood that there'll be a lot of Republican senators there and less Democratic senators.
Right, ISS, John, because you get into a numbers game here. There are 53 Senate Republicans, two, Murkowski of Alaska and Collins of Maine, have suggested they will not go along with the nomination, out of principle, not personally, mm-hmm. just out of principle. That takes you down to 51 votes, John, so you have one vote to spare, and now we have three Republicans who have tested positive. So McConnell cannot get 50 votes in person right now, so I'm just curious as to how he would try to rig this, how he would just work the system to his advantage if he doesn't have 50 votes.
Yeah, there's a very limited thing he can do. For example, it doesn't require for confirmation, for example, to be a majority of all senators in existence, right? It doesn't have to be 51 senators. If you're McConnell, you're counting noses, you know that once you have a quorum, it's a majority of the senators present. So you might try to schedule the vote when you know that some people who are in the opposition also may not be able to get back to Washington. You might say, the senators from California, Kamala Harris, you're busy. Why don't you stay on the campaign trail? Right. Senator Feinstein, why fly all the way back? Stay out of California and put out some fires. McConnell has that kind. That's really the only thing he can do, I think, is try to schedule a vote where there might also be Democratic senators who aren't that eager to get back to Washington because, right, as you said, it could be the week right before the election. There are going to be senators up for re-election who'd much rather spend the day on the campaign trail with just a week to go, you're talking about 5 days to go before the election rather than spend a whole day flying back to Washington to cast that vote. But, but it is true. You got to be there. There are some very famous examples where senators showed up almost on their deathbeds to cast a vote. Senator McCain coming back to, I think he was being treated for cancer at the time, coming back to vote against the override on Obamacare. There's also this famous story of the last vote to acquit President Johnson back in the first impeachment trial. could be, you know, on his deathbed being brought in on a stretcher to cast the vote that actually led to his acquittal. You have story. I think Ted Kennedy came back and voted for the first passage of Obamacare. So you have these stories, but the reason why is because you can't vote by proxy.
I'll give you one from the 1980s, John. That's your friend of mine, Pete Wilson. Pete Wilson at the time was a senator from California, and he suffered an attack of appendicitis. He had to go to Bethesda Naval Hospital and have an emergency appendectomy, and he was laid up there at the same time that Bob Dole, at the time the majority leader, was trying to get a deficit reduction bill passed through the Senate, and he needed Wilson's vote. So what they did was they literally carried him out of the hospital on a
gurney. Really?
Put him into an ambulance. Drove him over to Capitol Hill, carried him onto the floor. He cast his vote, and it passed. And of course, Bob Dole kind of stepped on the moment there by saying that Wilson, in effect, does his best work when he's hopped up on.
That does sound like Dole. You know, there's that great Dole joke. I mean, I actually love Dole. He was a majority leader when I worked in the Senate, and you know, he's so funny. You know, he had to put out a book of jokes. It is hilarious. So he has this. I thought the best joke in there was he was at a funeral, I think it was for maybe President Johnson. And he said, sitting there, he had, you know, there was Ford, Carter, and Nixon. And apparently Dole said, hear no evil, see no evil, and evil.
Well, Bob Dole won me over after the 96 election, John. We're getting off back in a second. But after he loses the election, he goes on Saturday Night Live. And Norm MacDonald had been doing
yes.
Bob Dole imitations. And so the joke was Norm MacDonald was now out of a job. So Norm MacDonald's sitting by the creek. And Bob Dole sits down next to him and pats him on the shoulder and says, Bob Dole understands how Bob Dole feels.
Because that's right, because he always referred himself in the third person.
Exactly, Bob Dole. Okay, back to business. Is now talking about the health of the president. So again, we're doing this before noon on the West Coast, and so who knows what changes over the next few hours. But there is confusion in Washington. The confusion is this, John. The president's medical team came out. The president's physician said that he had a mild cough, nasal congestion, fatigue, and then the words he used was all resolving and improving. In other words, the impression the president's getting better. He's going to kick this. Mm-hmm. Then a source close to the president's treatment, we don't know who it is, but they dropped a statement on the press pool, and the statement read the following, John, quote, the president's vitals over the last 24 hours were very concerning, and the next 48 hours will be critical in terms of his care. We're still not on a clear path to a full recovery. This, of course, sends the media into a full frenzy over his health. Coupled with the great Washington guessing game. What was it? Howard Baker who said, when did the president know and when did he know it? This is now the question of when did the president get infected and who infected him? This great guessing
game. Should be, when did the president cough and when did he, where did he cough and when did he cough?
Exactly, which is why I mentioned the Rose Garden ceremony, because I think seven people at that ceremony have now been infected. So some people are thinking, that was it. But then no, maybe it's a plane ride to Cleveland. Who knows exactly? Anyway, we have a lot of guessing in Washington, John, and that leads us now to our favorite game. Is it constitutional? And today's topic is the 25th Amendment. Boy, remember those cartoons on Sunday mornings, John, on ABC explaining the Constitution of government? Yes. Fraggle Rock was in it.
I love those. That's the first time I learned about how a bill passed.
We need those back, and I think maybe you need to do these, or do these for Hoover, just explaining. But let's talk about the 25th Amendment, John. It's really funny how these amendments start popping up, and people don't know anything about them until now they become germane. So the 25th Amendment of the Constitution, quote, presidential disability and succession. John, you know this better than all, but I just will read this to the audience. The amendment comes in four sections. Section one, quote, in case of the removal of the president from office or his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president. I need to add her in there, I guess. But anyway, it says very clearly, in case the president dies or resigns, vice president becomes president. Easy enough. Mm-hmm. Section two, John, quote, whenever there is a vacancy in the office of the vice president, the president shall nominate a vice president who shall take office upon confirmation by a majority vote of both the House of Congress, both houses of Congress. So that's Gerald Ford and Nelson Rockefeller, right? Mm-hmm. Section three, John, and here's where we get to the nitty-gritty of this, section three and section four. Section three reads, quote, whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives his written declaration that he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and until he transmits to them a written declaration to the contrary, such powers, duties shall be discharged by the vice president as acting president. then section four, John, and it's really longer than this, but I just want to give you the gist of it. Quote, whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of other such body as Congress may by law provide, transmit to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office as acting president. So, John, basically, this is Congress, this is the United States government, the framework, the Constitution, laying out the following. What happens if the president dies in office? Yeah. Secondly, what happens if the vice president is no more? And then thirdly, what if the president is incapacitated or if the president is deemed just mentally unfit for the job? So all these guidelines. But it seems to me, John, that this doesn't really invoke what we're dealing with the pandemic right now. And that's the idea. If the president is sick, if there is a chance the president could get worse and could overtake him suddenly, and I'm not wishing this, by the way, we're just doing this hypothetically, but should the president be doing this proactively? In other words, the 25th Amendment, John, it's not like a letter that you leave in your safe. Look at this, if I die, and you'll know the true killer. This is, the idea would be, should the president, if he is in a situation where he very quickly could become incapacitated or in a delirious, if you will, not even able to do his office, should the president proactively, John, be invoking this amendment?
I think that, now this amendment is passed in 1967, of course, it's in reaction to the Kennedy assassination. And that's, as you say, this does fill a gap in the Constitution that had already existed, because that gap had, you know, as you could see, it thinks about presidents. And this is an Article 2 of the Constitution, actually. The only provision that had been there before was about, you know, you remove the president because that's an impeachment, and then death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers of the office, it goes to the vice president. And then removal, death, resignation, or inability of both the president and the vice president, then Congress passes a law to take care of that. But as you say, Bill, doesn't those previous provisions didn't handle this kind of case that we've got before us now? And so the section three that you read is there, and it's been used three times, I think once by Reagan, twice by George W. Bush, was when there's time for a president who knows he's going to be incapacitated and then can voluntarily transfer power to the vice president, right, and then take it back when he's okay. That's a thing that Trump ought to do now, if he can, before he gets worse, while he's still conscious and fully alert and rational. So now section four is the only other alternative that you can use in the possible hypothetical that the president, you know, suddenly, as you said, becomes delirious, still alive. And it's quite cumbersome, right? It requires two people, two bodies. At first, the vice president. Nobody can do anything unless the vice president acts. Right. And only if the vice president convinces a majority of, loosely, the cabinet to agree with him that the president is disabled, can the vice president become acting president. That's all there is. There's no kind of smooth transition. If there's a smooth transition, it can only happen if the president's conscious. Once he falls unconscious, then you need the vice president to step in and to, you know, assemble the signature. And the interesting thing is, this is often the source of many TV shows and Air Force One movies and so on. It's probably a provision. It's a provision maybe most Americans kind of have a feeling of from popular culture, yet this provision is never taught in law school or political science, because we thought the odds of this happening were tiny, if not infinitesimal.
Right. So there's something that sounds very non-Washington about this, John, and that's the idea that in a town where nobody resigns unless they're basically, you know, the law is breathing down their neck. Nobody does a gracious thing and volunteers, you know, and resigns in shame. People do not willingly give up power. So the idea that the president would transfer his power without being forced to. In other words, you mentioned the past uses this. I believe Reagan had surgery when he was in office, so he was under anesthesia, so he could not govern. I think Bush 43. I think colonoscopies were why.
Yeah, it was also anesthesia.
But,
yes.
But again, the same thing. You're out for an hour or two. You can't do the job. In other words, you know exactly when you can't do it. You know exactly when you're coming back. So the idea that the president would do this and do it in kind of an open-ended fashion, John, is kind of what fascinates me. And so the question is, if you did this in open-ended fashion, how do you get the job back?
So this is interesting. So if you do it voluntarily while you're still conscious, Article 3 says, when you come back as president, all you have to do is say that you're back. Okay. You just let them know that you're able to, you let the, it's really the Senate and the House know that you're back. The interesting thing is section four, the one where the president, you know, say he becomes delirious, falls unconscious before he can transfer power under article section three, much more complicated. And the reason it's written this way is because you could see a situation where an ambitious vice president in cahoots with the cabinet could try to seize power from the sitting president. So they wanted to, the people who wrote the amendment wanted to make it easy to start the transfer of power, but they also wanted to make it very, very easy for the president to claim it back. So the way it works is, suppose President Trump falls unconscious, Pence comes in, gets a majority of the cabinet to agree with him. In writing, they say the president's disabled. Pence becomes acting vice president immediately upon that getting a majority of the cabinet. Then say Trump wakes up. And suppose Pence and the majority of the cabinet say, nah, stay in bed, rest a little bit. You don't need to come back to the job. Suppose Trump wants to come back to the job. All Trump has to do is declare that he is now fit again to hold office. He becomes president again immediately, unless, and this is only if, Pence and the majority of the cabinet again certify that Trump's not able to perform the office, and two-thirds of the House and the Senate back Pence up. If neither of those two things happen, Trump automatically is president again. So you can see how it's like weighted to make it extremely easy. All Trump needs is one-third of the Senate, basically, to agree with him, and he's immediately president again.
Okay, let's play a little Vulcan three-dimensional chess now. Let's talk about a scenario in which the president has transferred his powers to the vice president. And what happens, John, if the vice president tests positive for the virus? The vice president has to go to Walter Reed Medical Center, and the vice president is maybe not able to carry out the job of his office. Who does he pass the job on to?
So this is a great question, Bill, because the Constitution doesn't really talk about what happens to a disability.
No, exactly, because I'm looking at the 25th Amendment, and it says the words that stick out are death and resignation.
Yes, there's nothing that really talks about the disability of the vice president. Right. So here's the thing, you got to go back to the original Constitution. And this is what I was saying, the founders, you know, they had just lived through a period of revolution, military coups, terrible politics, you know, politics much worse than the kind we have now. And so they've kind of tried to think out all these possible outcomes. So there is a provision, and it says, in case of the removal, death, resignation, and then here's it, or inability, both of the president and vice president, Congress could provide and pass a law that declares, now here's the key language, what officer, quote unquote,
right,
shall then act as president? And then after the set of things you just talked about, president's knocked out temporarily, vice president's knocked out temporarily, the 25th Amendment doesn't address it. So you have to go to some act, hopefully, that Congress passed. And Congress did pass such an act called the Succession Act of 1947. So you have to go back and look at that.
So when you read stories in RSA in passing, conservative scholars say that actually the job would not go to Nancy Pelosi, it would go to a member of the cabinet, an officer. This is what they're referring to, right? This is how conservatives interpret the Constitution.
Yes. You have to go back and look at the Secession Act, but the Secession Act has to be constitutional too.
Right.
And this is the problem, I think, is the Secession Act, it says in the case of this disability, president is first, vice president goes second. Third is the Speaker of the House. Fourth is the Senate President Pro Tem.
Chuck Grassley.
You know, right. It's Chuck Grassley right now. I think it's usually done, if I remember, by seniority in the Senate. Then it goes to the Secretary of State, and then the order is, it's funny, this is so Washington, I guess, the order in which the cabinet agency had been created by Congress. So, you know, the big four, you know, state, defense, treasury, I think it goes state, treasury, the good old days, war, but now defense, and then the attorney general, I think, and then it goes down. I think maybe it goes all the way down. Maybe, I think, either HUD or education is the last one, perhaps. Oh, no, Homeland Security would be the last one created. So that's interesting, because you would think maybe Homeland Security is more important than in terms of the duties a new president would face than, say, education or HUD. But it goes down in that list of order of creation.
Right, which, by the way, getting back to pop culture, being fascinated with this, there was that TV show, series, I think it was on ABC. It was Lone Survivor, is that what it was called?
Yeah, with Kiefer.
Kiefer, right, where he's the only cabinet secretary not to go to the State of the Union. The place gets blown up, and now he's the president.
What was he like, secretary of the, what was he like? I don't even remember which department he was in charge of. The EPA, maybe.
I know, so every time I watch him, he's always running, he's always yelling. 24 is always that way. Get out!
Yeah. I think the 25th Amendment made many, many appearances in the show 24.
So, John, there's one thing the 25th Amendment does not cover, and that's elections. So let's now talk about the president.
Can I pause? I didn't explain the other part of your question, which is why do some people, including me, think parts of the Secession Act are unconstitutional?
Yeah, explain the conservative-liberal divide on this.
Yeah, I don't know what liberals per se think, because liberals have made this argument too when there have been Republican speakers, I might add. Although my teacher at Yale is the one where I first heard this argument, and I agreed with him at that time 30 years ago when I heard of it, and I, since doing research, I really agree with him now. And this is the idea that, notice that the Constitution says that the Congress passes a law which, quote unquote, declares what officer shall then act as president, unquote, when you have inability. And so officer is a particular term that the Constitution uses. It almost always uses it to refer to an officer of the executive branch. It's usually officer of the United States is the phrase that's usually used in the Constitution, that always refers to an executive branch officer, mm-hmm. which makes sense, because members of Congress are not referred to in the Constitution as officers. They're referred to as, you know, members, or they're referred to as speaker, right? Or a senator. So my reading of it is that phrase officer can't refer to a legislative branch member. Mm-hmm. So that it has to be an executive, and for two reasons. One is putting aside that text, but there are one or two other places in the Constitution where officer sometimes refers to state government officers, interestingly, right. Or sometimes refers to just anybody who takes an oath to the Constitution who's a member of the government. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the right reading for two reasons. One is, first, there is another clause in the Constitution called the incompatibility clause, it's called. And this was written in response to what the framers thought is some of the evils of the British Constitution and its system, which was you would have members of parliament who were also officers of the executive branch there. And it was seen as a way, actually, that the king had corrupted parliament by offering them fancy titles with lots of money. So the framers actually said, no one can be a member of the executive branch and the legislative branch at the same time. It's right. incompatible. And then the second reason is it goes back to the basic separation of powers of the government. The framers wanted the executive branch to be independent of Congress. They didn't want to have a situation where the House and the Senate had undue influence over the officers. You could see all kinds of situations where this provision, if it did allow the Speaker of the House and the Senate pro tem to be in the line of succession, they might do things like impeach the president and vice president in order to get their jobs. You could see situations where, the situations like this one now. I'm not saying it's happening now, but you could see situations now where people start invoking the 25th Amendment in order to get to a situation where someone's favored speaker becomes right. So instead, I think the founders wanted the executive and legislative branches to be sort of hermetically sealed away from each other in terms of personnel. And so it makes much more sense, I think, constitutionally to read officer as only being executive branch. So that means the insertion of Pelosi and Grassley is unconstitutional. And so if it's not Pence, it goes to Pompeo. That's how you get to President Pompeo.
Mm-hmm. So do we need to amend the 25th Amendment, John?
You could have a procedure in there that would handle things like this. So it seems to handle cases like, okay, the president, as you say, knows in advance, like you said, knows he's going to have surgery and when he's going to come out.
Right.
And then sometime when the president suddenly falls unconscious, you know, it's totally unexpected, unanticipated. And Bill, what you talk about here is this kind of something like COVID, something where you have a disease, which, gives you some time, but it could be quick and it's unpredictable. That kind of falls in between that Section 3 and Section 4 of the 24th Amendment. There is, for example, one thing some people proposed is maybe presidents should be able to delegate their power more so that they can have other executive branch members. You know, Nixon actually had this interesting idea. He thought the job of president was so hard and that required presidents individually to sign so many things, make so many decisions. If not for Watergate, it would have been interesting what would have happened. He actually proposed having two deputy presidents. I think he actually was thinking about making George Shultz, our Hoover colleague, one of those two deputy presidents, one in charge of foreign affairs, one in charge of domestic affairs, who would be like, you know, assistants, assistant presidents. Something like that might be a better transition, you know, in terms of someone being sick and getting sicker. So, for example, and I think it's even worse, Bill, suppose someone, look, we have two candidates who in there now are in their, you know, late 70s. What if a president gets Alzheimer's? Exactly. Like, this is a perfect example. You, as you say, this is a president who may be unwilling to voluntarily sign a Section 3 transfer of power order. But on section under Section 4, he's still conscious and alert. And maybe he's 75, 80% there. That seems to fall through the cracks of the 25th Amendment, too.
Mm-hmm. But to amend the 25th Amendment, you'd have to take it through Congress. You need 2/3 votes in both chambers, right?
Yeah, and 3/4 of the state legislatures.
Okay, so good luck getting 2/3 of Congress and 37 states to agree on anything, right?
Yes. Yeah. Although that might be one positive reaction from having two geriatrics run for president this year.
That's true. By the way, that's why I'm always fascinated, the idea of bringing in Puerto Rico and D.C. and statehood. You're not going to get a 2/3 approval in Congress. Even if you did by some miracle, more than 13 states are going to object to that. So I don't understand why you would seriously talk about that. But I guess that's just about appealing to certain votes. But back to the 25th Amendment, John, and something that's not covered in it, and that is elections. And again, I hope people are not too queasy with us talking about this, but this does get into a fascinating scenario with if the president's incapacitated at the time of the vote. Now, voting's actually begun in America, John. I think something like 2.2 million votes have already been cast, according to the U.S. Wow. Elections Project, the University of Florida. You and I are sitting here in California. My brick of a voting guide showed up the other day, which means that the ballot is not far behind, so you can start voting now. So the election's underway, and people are marking their ballots for Donald Trump and Mike Pence or Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. But let's talk about an election, John, in which the president is ill, and if, God forbid, something worse happens to the president, either before the election or shortly thereafter. Explain how the wheels of government turn, how the wheels of the election will turn.
Yeah, okay, Bill, you may know more about this than I do, because you know the workings of political parties and how they think, which seems often to be a mystery, but I could walk through the legal part. And what you said is quite right. We wish we never had to think about this. On the other hand, that's why you have lawyers.
So then let me step in and just quickly do the political side.
Do you think through unpleasant future policy? Right.
So the political side is simply this. If President Trump were incapacitated and the decision were be to pull him out of the game, if you will, the Republican National Committee could nominate a new nominee. They'd have to call a full meeting of the Republican National Committee members and vote on it. But here's the problem, John. It's
the ballots already out there.
People have already voted on Donald Trump. So what happens to that ballot? You don't get to vote twice in America. I don't think you can't pull it back in.
Well, depends which city you're in.
Okay. My apologies to you Chicago listeners, but people have already voted on Donald Trump. What if Donald Trump, incapacitated or taken away by his party, wins the election with Mike
Pence? This is interesting. But
anyway, so there is a mechanism by the Republican National Committee to replace somebody, but this is not talked about 4 weeks before an election.
Yeah, I remember it came up 4 years ago, didn't it, with the Access Hollywood tape. You know, there were people who said maybe Donald Trump should step aside and Mike Pence should be the named candidate. So I remember people talking it through then. But then there's a set of – so then this is an interesting mixture of the political rules of governing a party and then the constitutional rules that govern the election. Because – and here I think the much maligned, old-fashioned electoral college could come in and save us.
Well, that's what I want you to get into. But just to close out the political side, John – So people think, ooh, this is the Nikki Haley scenario, that the Republicans could neatly insert Nikki Haley into the election and that solves every problem. But
no,
setting aside the fact that Nikki Haley's largely unknown to a lot of Americans, you're telling me that the 20 to 30 to 50 Republicans out there who all want to run in 2024, they're going to stand by politely, Ted Cruz, they're going to just stand by and say, yeah, let's give it to Nikki Haley. That's not
exactly.
So anyway, so between just the feasibility of coming up with the nominee, John, but then just what do you do with the ballots? Because they've already been printed, they've already been distributed.
Yeah.
I think
it's too late.
Yeah, you have the Trump-Pence ticket. So now let's talk about the legalities of what happens if you're voting for or even elect a president who is incapacitated or, God forbid, dies. Yeah.
So let me just preface it by saying I think the founders did prepare for this eventuality. Again, I said they were willing to think out all kinds of options that we haven't had to think about because they had been through such turmoil in their lives. Right. And they seen kind of everything happen, including an entire revolution. On the other hand, I think in our history, this has only happened once. This was, I believe this, so we don't know exactly what would happen, but we have one case, which was the re-election of Ulysses S. Grant in 1872. And so his main opponent, which you know, gives hope to newspaper publishers everywhere, was Horace Greeley, the publisher of the main paper in New York City at the time, ran against Grant. And he died, I think, after the election, but before the casting of the electoral vote. So that's the only history we have to go on. But this is how I think the rules work. So when you vote for Donald Trump or Joe Biden, say in California or any state, you're not really voting for them. You're right. Voting for a slate of electors. These are people chosen by both parties, and they pledge, because the Constitution actually doesn't talk about any direct election by the people for the president. All the Constitution says is the state legislatures shall provide for the selection of the presidential electors. And it's those electors who choose the president. And in the beginning, sometimes state legislatures didn't even have elections for president. They just, right. The states would just pick the electors, and the founders thought they would get together and they would pick from the great people of the day and choose the president. They didn't anticipate this idea of organized parties running the same candidate in every state. But of course, that happens almost right away. So when you vote in California, when you and I vote in California, we pick, say, Donald Trump or Joe Biden, we're really selecting these electors. Now, this is where the Electoral College could save us in a way. So if you're a elector who's pledged to Trump, suppose Trump were to die or fall incapacitated, and maybe there's no prospect for him to recover. I suppose he has, and everybody does it. Then the electors, the RNC could try to organize all the electors in the country and mm-hmm. say, instead of picking Donald Trump for president, pick Pence. Or, as you said, pick Nikki Haley or pick Pompeo, but give them all the same person to put down because they are allowed to pick whoever they want. Now, this is another interesting twist. Just this year, just this few months ago, the Supreme Court decided a case called the Faithless Electors case, right. Where the court said a state can punish an elector who doesn't live up to their promise. So these were cases actually from just 4 years ago where some people who are, say, pledged for Trump or Hillary Clinton, somebody else, like voted for Kasich, for example, in Ohio, God knows why, but they did. And they were fined. They were subject to fines and even imprisonment. But the Constitution still says they can vote for whoever they want to. They could take the punishment if they want. And also, I think they could say, look, it's not that I broke my promise. It's that the guy I was going to vote for has actually died or can't serve in office. So I can and this was the, so in a way, it circles back to the founders' original idea that the electors would have discretion over who to pick for president. So if the RNC could coordinate all of them to pick this, to pick the same person, then that could potentially save us from that kind of chaos that might erupt.
But John, I thought different states had different standards. Michigan, for example, I thought Michigan required electors to vote for the winning candidate who appeared on the ballot. Indiana, I believe, gives electors the ability to switch parties if the candidates died. But I thought electors in states were beholden.
That's the interesting question that the Supreme Court faced this summer. So state law, yeah, almost all the states actually require, I think all the states actually do. They do require that the electors keep their promises. But the question arose, what happens if they don't? This is interesting because the Constitution, there's federal officers. The electors are federal officers. How could it be that state laws can tell them what to do? Could a state pass a law telling a senator how to vote, for example? Right. And so the court usually has said, no, states can't do that. But it also, in this case, as Summer said, if they break their pledges under state law, you can still punish them. You can still fine them or imprison them. Mm-hmm. But they didn't go far, I believe, as saying, and the state can cancel their electoral vote and replace it with somebody else's. So once you're an elector, you have a you're a federal officer for that job, and I think you can still, you know, you'll suffer for it. You'll still suffer punishment, but you can say, look, state law can't actually tell me how to cast my vote, and I'm going to cast it for Mike Pence because Donald Trump is not available.
Okay, I guess I'm still trying to make sense of this. Yeah.
No, okay. that's a very fine distinction. And I think that's just the little crack of the door that was left open by the Supreme Court. Because, of course, they assume every elector is not going to be doesn't want to spend time in jail or pay a big penalty because they promised to vote for Trump and instead they vote for some other Republican.
Okay, so let's clarify it again. So 538 electors gather to vote.
In their states, yes.
In their states on December the 14th. Yes. And Donald Trump has 270 plus electors. So yes. He should be reelected president, but Donald Trump is in a position where his health is questioned.
Yes, or he's died, or suppose he's died.
Right, yeah. But let's just say there's a question about his health. Either he is gone, or else he is in a situation where he probably should not be governing. So, yes. Are you telling me that the 270 electors are then on their own to choose whoever they want?
I think so, and they can be punished by their states. Now, here's the other tricky thing is, and this is what also happened with Greeley back in 1872. Although Greeley did not win a majority, Ulysses Grant won, but Greeley passed away. His electors didn't coordinate, and I think they ended up casting votes for like four different people. So this is what I think is actually more likely. Suppose there's ambiguity. Donald Trump is still alive, but maybe he's knocked out by the disease. Maybe he's in a coma. Maybe it's not clear whether he's going to recover. There is no coordination. They don't all agree on one person. Then that means that no one wins a majority of the Electoral College. This is actually something that the founders did think about. So it says then in the Constitution, if no one wins a majority of the electoral vote, which I imagine what happened in the facts you're posing, Bill, then it goes under the 12th and 20th Amendments, it goes to the House of Representatives.
They vote by delegation.
And they vote by state delegation, one by one, where California has the same number of votes as Wyoming.
But are their choices limited to who's on the ballot, or can they freelance at that point?
No, so they can't. The Constitution specifically says you have to pick from amongst the top three vote getters in the Electoral College.
Okay, so under that scenario, John, if Republican, right now it's a split, is what, 26-23-1, I believe, Pennsylvania?
One tie. Yep,
one tie, right. State. Okay, so if we run those numbers in December of 2020, Donald Trump would be one of the three choices. They would vote for Donald Trump. So now you have elected someone who cannot constitutionally.
This is exactly right. And so then Constitution even keeps going on this. I actually am impressed by how far they thought all these things through. Again, these are provisions almost people really haven't looked at in 100 years, right? We have the last contested election in the House was 1824. And before that, there was the only one in 18. There was one in 1876, but it actually got worked out. So then there was a deal made. So it never was contested. So yeah. So then what happens? Well, then you still have a president who's disabled, right? He's still elected president, but he can't take the oath of office, right? So he is unable to be president. So then I think you could there's two things you could go to. So the one is, this is interesting. The 20th Amendment, which was passed in 1933, does talk about this. So it says, if at the time fixed for the beginning of the term of the president, the president-elect shall have died, the vice president-elect shall be president. So that's the first scenario. Right? They just specifically addressed it. Suppose Donald Trump does win the electoral vote, and suppose he gets it in the House, but he were to die before January 20th at noon, then Mike Pence, should he become vice president, would win.
Okay, now I'm going to have a little fun with you, John. We're now going to go to four-dimension chess. We have now laid out a scenario in which President Trump, incapable of handling his job, is actually reelected by the House. But over in the Senate, the Democrats have picked up the Senate. And I can easily point you to the map, John, and show you how they get four seats. So in a 51-49 vote, the Senate votes for whom? Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris.
So now President Trump is a president-elect, if you will. He should be sworn in again on January the 20th, but he's not physically able to do it. Or would you take a judge to his bedside in Walter Reed and do it there? But meanwhile, what about Kamala Harris? Would Kamala Harris then try to invoke the 25th Amendment? But here's the problem. She'd have to go to Republican cabinet to get them to vote.
Well, here's the interesting thing. The 20th Amendment still has another provision about this. Okay. So before you get to the 25th, so then it says, if a president shall not have been chosen for the time fixed for beginning term, or if the president-elect shall have failed to qualify. So some people think that means the president can't qualify because he couldn't take the oath. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's still alive, right? Mm-hmm. So he's still, but he hasn't qualified yet. Then the vice president-elect shall act as president until a president shall have qualified. Mm-hmm. So if you read that, that sounds like, okay, suppose that Senate picks Kamala Harris.
Right.
And Trump is still disabled. Maybe Kamala Harris can be acting president until Trump comes back and can qualify, i.e. take the oath. Mm-hmm. Then Kamala Harris is reduced back to being vice president. That doesn't require, a majority of the cabinet or anything like that. I think what you're talking about with the 25th Amendment coming in then would occur if, I think, Trump does get in all the ways. Suppose he then has a miraculous recovery, is able to take the oath, becomes president, and then he has a relapse. right, then you're right. Then I think Kamala Harris is the vice president, but you're completely right. She needs to get a majority of the cabinet to agree with her. And that cabinet is presumably, right? And actually, this is another aspect of federal law, right? The Secretary of State, Pompeo, the Secretary of Defense, Esper, they're all still in those offices until either they resign or they're replaced, even in a change of administration. If it's a Kamala Harris now, she could fire them. Now, this is another that gets even worse. So she could, I guess, if she becomes acting president, or if she's vice president and doesn't become acting president, then it's not clear whether she, I don't think she could actually fire them. Only the president can remove them from office. So you're right, Bill. The Trump cabinet is still sitting there. Right. Kamala Harris has to persuade a majority of them to allow her to trigger the 25th Amendment. I hadn't thought that through, but that's got to be right.
Let me throw another scenario at you. We haven't talked about Joe Biden, who has tested negative for this. We wish him the best. Mike Pence has also tested negative, by the way. I imagine these guys are getting tested around the clock. There's also a vice presidential debate on Wednesday, I believe. I believe it's on right now, but we'll see if he actually goes through that. Now we're concerned about everyone's health. What about a scenario, John, in which Joe Biden tests positive and Joe Biden becomes incapacitated? He wins the election on November 3rd. And sometime between November 3rd and December 14th, he gets struck down by coronavirus and he is incapacitated. What happens in the Electoral College? And then what about then, and going on with this scenario, what about the reverse scenario where Biden wins the presidency and the Republicans hold on to the Senate? Would Biden then get chosen? What would the Republican-controlled House or Democratic House do about it? And what would happen then if Pence were chosen by a Republican Senate and you had Joe Biden in a position where he couldn't lead?
So this would only happen if no one got a majority of the Electoral College.
Right,
so
it's all preface on that.
Yeah,
right.
So if Biden and Harris ticket gets a majority, then there's no way Pence could ever get to the Senate and become vice president. But suppose Biden and Harris don't get a majority, but they're, Biden's picked in the House. Or suppose he runs through, Biden gets a majority, but he falls ill. Then I think you've got that 20th Amendment provision. He can't take the oath. He's out of it. He's never inaugurated. So he doesn't qualify as president. Then I think whoever the vice president is. Now, if Harris just got enough electoral votes, then she becomes the acting president. Mm-hmm. Until Biden recovers and he can take the oath of office. But if, say that the election, there was no majority because of the confusion, right? You'd have to get suppose Biden Harris won 270 electoral votes, Biden falls sick. You would have to, you might have some electors who don't vote the way they're supposed to. So no one gets a majority, goes to the House and Senate. Yes, then you could see that situation you just talked about, because if the Republicans keep the Senate, they would probably pick Pence to become vice president. And then Biden becoming ill, not taking oath, that would make Pence the acting president until Biden recovers. If Biden doesn't recover, then Pence just continues as president. In fact, I would say, not to draw it out too far, but suppose Biden never recovers, then it's impossible for anyone ever to qualify as president. Then Pence just becomes permanently the president for that four-year term.
Oh boy.
And right, this is, this is more getting into your world, Bill, but one of the points of the Electoral College and these rules was to give the election of the president legitimacy. And, you had Gerald Ford, who, right, people always said he'd never been elected president or vice president, right? He was the first guy who became president, never got elected to either of the chief executive branch offices. Mm-hmm. And you could see this system where Pence could win this way, or say Pompeo got it through the law of secession, but they'll almost have no political legitimacy. And I think their presidencies would be under attack for the whole 4 years. The other historical example I could point to was the election of 1824, where Andrew Jackson had a plurality of the electoral votes and a plurality of the popular vote. John Quincy Adams came in second, and Henry Clay, I think, might have come in fourth. And then it went to the House because there were four candidates, so nobody got a majority. It goes to the House, and according to the histories, John Quincy Adams said, "Clay, you throw me your supporters in the House," because Clay had a lot of supporters in the House, "and I'll make you Secretary of State." And then Jackson spent the next 4 years attacking. He called it the corrupt bargain, and he really, I think you read accounts of that administration, and Adams had a serious problem of Democratic legitimacy the whole time. And then Jackson crushed him in the 1828 elections.
Exactly. Okay, let me throw one more scenario. There's more. it's like a bad infomercial, but wait, there's more.
If I buy five of them, will you stop? Yeah. Stop now.
4 weeks out, the president's tested positive. What if Joe Biden tests positive? Is there any way to postpone the election to put it off for a month or two until they're both healthy and able to debate and campaign in earnest?
No.
Congress
could change the date of the election. That's true.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, right now there's no way, but yeah, Congress could change the date of the election. That's certainly true. They just can't have it go on into January, I think, 3rd. Yeah, January 3rd is the date when you have to open the electoral, right? You start opening the electoral votes. They have to be cast. Now, there's a federal law called the Electoral Count Act, which does set deadlines for the casting of the electoral votes from the transmission from the state, the states, because the electors meet in the states, they cast their votes there, and then they mail them. So they still actually mail them. I think they have to send them certified mail. It's actually in the statute. Exactly. Yeah, they'll still be there. They'll get lost in the with all the absentee ballots, but nonetheless. So the federal law sets deadlines for those, but you could change all those, or you could just ignore them and votes in later. They have to be there by January 3rd, because that's the date the Constitution sets for opening and counting the electoral votes in Congress. So yeah, I guess you could postpone the election a few weeks.
I could, but let's put a very wet blanket on that for one simple reason. One party's candidate has a pretty healthy lead in the national polls.
Would you agree
to House Democrats, why don't you say, sure, we'll give you another month to catch up.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, right, if you're the Republicans, right, you control the White House, the president has to sign the law. He may not be able to if he's incapacitated, but if he's unwell, he could still sign it. And the Republicans control the Senate. Why would they ever agree to postponing the election unless it would be in Donald Trump? It would help Donald Trump, not hurt him in the election.
John, why do we move up the inauguration from March to January?
Oh, well, in part because of right, so it's moved during FDR's presidency.
Too long of a transition, or just?
Yeah, there was a lot of monkey business that could. Well, two things. One is there's a lot of political monkey business that could occur in there. For example, this actually applies to the Amy Coney Barrett situation. Presidents would still be in office if the Senate of their party was still in office all the way to March. They could, right? Not just pack the courts, they could pack the administrative state. They could fill all the offices. They could, if the House is in their control, they could pass laws, expand. So the lame duck period where you could do things without political repercussions if you had lost, it was not just December, it extended all the way to March. And so actually a number of Supreme Court justices are confirmed in that period historically who would never have been appointed and confirmed by the winning party.
John, Mitch McConnell would be what Joey Chestnut is, the hot dog eating contest. He would, how many federal judges could he manage to put in November and March?
That's what John Adams did. So back then, Jefferson won the election of 1800. John Adams was president until March. He passed a bill expanding the size of the file courts. He nominated and confirmed Chief Justice John Marshall in that period. Right? He tried to stack the courts against the Jeffersonians. But the other thing was, and this is, I think, more reason why you see it happen during FDR, there was this sense that now, and I think it's proved only true later in the 20th century, is you don't want the country to have this kind of interregnum period where it's not clear really who's in charge. Suppose there's some great threat that occurs in that time period. Suppose we fell under attack. Suppose there's a war during that time. You could see that being a time where we're especially vulnerable to foreign countries and rivals. So the idea was to shorten it. But your suggestion, Bill, is right. If there's a lot of unclarity in the election, if there's a lot of uncertainty or external shocks like this, like COVID occur, it gives you very little time to resolve all of that if you have a dispute.
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem. For example, we talked about postponing the election to December. That means you said you have to get things cleaned up by January 3rd to have the transition on January 20th. In addition to giving the winner of the election 17 days to form a cabinet, we've talked about this on previous podcasts, John. Now you're going to certify the vote in less than a month in this country, given all the mail-ins. So January 20th doesn't do the cushion. So I think March, the first Tuesday in March is when they did it, back in the old days with FDR and others, but you're right.
An even more radical thing that could save us all out of this is if you go back to the Constitution, remember it says state legislatures provide for picking the electors. So suppose all these terrible things, Bill, that you've described happen. Right. Then you could also see the state legislature saying, okay, yeah, there's the vote's uncertain, deadlines are coming, we're doing recounts, people are suing, we're not even sure if the candidates are in good shape. The states could just say, damn it, we'll pick the electors. They could always do that under the Constitution. They could say, we'll take back all these things we do. And it says state legislatures. So I don't know if that requires them even to pass new laws. I don't even know if that requires them to get the governor's signature. I think, say, the Sacramento, right, the Assembly and the State Senate could get together and just say, we're going to pick all the electors. And I assume they would give them all to Biden or to Harris. And they would just say, we're going to end the uncertainty now.
You assume, but let's say Joe Biden carries Texas. Texas has a Republican legislature. Could Texas mischievously put a bunch of Republican electors in there? This gets back into the faithless issue.
Yes. No, that's exactly right. In fact, I would expect if the state legislatures decide to take the power back, you would have, let's say, Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania actually has a Republican legislature. It's the most fought over state. Maybe they are the state in the balance. And you could easily see Biden winning Pennsylvania by the popular vote.
Right. So now you need a legal safeguard, John, just saying that the elector has to honor the results of the election.
Yeah, you could do that too. This is sort of like this national popular vote initiative that's kicking around with some states. What if a state legislature just said, because of this uncertainty, we pledge to give our electors to whoever nationwide popular vote candidates could be are falling prey to this terrible disease. Now, this has never happened in our history, but I think under the Constitution, it is something that the state legislatures could do and maybe should be thinking about now.
Okay, so let's wrap this up, John. So I always like to look for fixes in these situations. So it sounds like some bright minds need to get together and figure the following situation. How do we avoid a situation where basically we have an election that turns out to be Weekend at Bernie's, where you're voting... You're voting for somebody who cannot handle the office.
Which one? Are you talking about Weekend at Bernie's 1 or the much maligned sequel, far inferior to the first one, Weekend at Bernie's 2?
Same premise, Bernie's gone, he's not coming back. No, seriously, a scenario in which you could get in a situation where the law, the Constitution is written in such a way where you end up electing somebody who obviously is not fit for office. So how would you amend the situation, John? How would you fix the system as written to avoid this kind of scenario?
Well, one thing you could do, I guess, is to clean up the Succession Act so that, because it seems to me if in a world like that, the Secretary of State, whoever it is not a bad default to run a kind of caretaker election. The other thing you could do is have that, the senior most, the most important cabinet officer is sort of the caretaker president, and then have a provision for, and this is quite typical in parliamentary systems. We just saw the UK go through this with Brexit, have some provision maybe for having an election short of once every 4 years. So you could have a system where maybe if the House and the Senate agree, or you could, you know, come up with something like, oh, the vice president, the majority can agree. But if the election is too close, or you've had disruption, or you have no obvious winner, why not just say, okay, we're going to have a caretaker government, and we're going to hold the election again in X number of months, 6 months, 3 months. That's what other democracies do in this kind of situation. And maybe that may be the better way to fix the problem.
Okay, I've got a fix for you, John. You, how about the president recovers quickly from this? The president's thus able to go out and debate on the 15th and the 22nd. The vice president stays healthy. He's able to debate Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, stay healthy. And we have a nice clean vote on November 3rd and don't have to worry about these constitutional things. Or by suggesting all that, John, should I go out and now get tested for COVID?
Well, no, I think the political scientists and constitutional law scholars have opposite interests, because the political scientists will probably all say, we hope it's a landslide. Right? If it's a landslide, no one cares what the Constitution says. But then no one cares about lawyers. Everything's obvious and easy and it's a landslide.
It is. Well, John, I really enjoyed the conversation. I look forward to talking to you next Saturday when we hit our next constitutional crisis.
Yeah, what else is going to happen next?
I don't know. Maybe the Martians land or something like that. We will see. Anyway, John, great conversation as always. Thanks for clarifying this. And what a great age you live in. You get to bring constitutional law to life.
Thank you. This is not the way I thought I would do it, but I'm really glad to be with you today, Bill. And who thought a year ago we would have had these many podcasts on the intricacies of the Electoral College, the 12th, 20th, and 25th Amendments.
Okay, John. Well, again, thanks for the conversation. Stay healthy, my friend.
You too.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this case, what happens if the 45th President is somehow incapable of carrying out his duties? If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of John Yoo and his Hoover Fellows to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. John Yoo is not on Twitter, but John Yoo has also been to the Oval Office. I'm not going to make a bad joke about tracing here, John, but... As I mentioned, by the way, you can hear John on the terrific Hoover Pacific Century podcast. And check out his book. It really is a great read. The book is Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. As always, thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.